We're still serving an incredible number of people who are absolutely struggling to make ends meet. They're not able to pay rent. They're not able to keep their utilities turned on without assistance.
A tough economy, people in need. Catholic Charities steps up to fill the void. The story through one woman's struggle to keep a roof over her head.
We do protect religion because religion is a good thing. That's the reason we have religious freedom.
After more than a decade of leading the Catholic University of America, we speak with outgoing President John Garvey about religious freedom, controversial changes to Title IX, and his new book, The Virtues. Compassion in Action, our Colm Flynn visits a Catholic orphanage in Africa where the staff is determined to give a better life to children from the streets.
Most of the time they can't do it themselves, don't have the money or are unable to, and it's just a great feeling.
And a summer with a mission. We talk to these teens about community service and how it strengthens their Catholic faith. EWTN News In Depth is next.
I really just got closer to God, and because I'm like, at the end of the day, only He knows what is happening, how this will result, and I know He's not going to see me and my son out in the street.
Like thousands of other Americans, this woman found herself in deep financial trouble, the high cost of housing and rent at the top of her worries. Welcome to EWTN News In Depth. Our focus, high prices for just about everything, and the gut punch it's having on your bank account. Pocketbook concerns are expected to be one of the top issues for voters casting their ballots in this fall's midterm elections. Who can voters trust to handle the economy? Republicans hope it will be a winning issue for them. Democrats say times are tough, but there are some signs inflation is slowing. Inflation numbers released this week by the Commerce Department show prices rose by 8.5% in July. While still high, that's a marked slowdown from the near-record pace of inflation in June. Meanwhile, the Producer Price Index dropped 0.5% in July, its first decline since April 2020, though compared to a year ago, still high at 9.8%. What appears to be an ease in inflation comes mostly from a steady drop in energy prices over the past 2 months. On Thursday, the national average price for a gallon of gas dropped below $4 for the first time since March.
I hesitate to say we've hit the peak. What we really need to see is a streak of a few months where we're seeing sustained improvement across a much broader range of categories than what we're currently seeing.
Food costs went up slightly over the past month, but are now 10.9% higher than last year, the largest annual increase since May of 1979. The price of food at home also soaring.
Food prices is probably, you know, the place where we didn't see as much progress as we'd like.
Inflation, staggering rent prices, and lingering effects from the pandemic sent millions of Americans scrambling for relief. Catholic Charities and other organizations have seen an uptick in people coming to them for assistance. Reporter Rizal Rages shares the story of one woman who doesn't know what would have happened to her if not for the help of Catholic Charities.
I came home to a big eviction notice on my door. And those notices only give you 48 to 72 hours to, like, do something or get out.
Serena Wills is a single mother living in Alexandria, Virginia. She's a self-published author and a National Board Certified Health and Wellness Coach who has a master's degree. But still, she struggles to find a full-time job. She currently works as a part-time virtual customer service provider. She described her income as scattered.
Literally, like, 1 week in June, I worked 5 hours, and that was it. And, like, this week, I'm only on the schedule for 7 hours. You know, so it's tricky. It goes up and down. You know, next week I'm on the schedule for 25 hours, but then the week after is like 5 hours.
But Wills doesn't have a lot of job options to choose from because she is considered high risk of contracting COVID. At the height of the pandemic, she lost her job.
I'm living the story that millions of people are living, where you go from having something to just completely nothing overnight. And you try to plan, you have all the best plans, and it's still like I had some savings, but that eventually was depleted, you know, and had credit cards, and eventually those get depleted.
During her financial struggle, she has relied on federal relief programs to keep her and her 10-year-old son in their home. But now that the national eviction ban has expired and state programs are running out of their share of the money, Wills, along with millions of other renters in America, are at risk of losing their homes.
It is so alarming and it is so frightening. And some neighbors, they didn't have a choice and they would just get out. They would just like leave in the middle of the night with all their stuff.
In early 2021, you know, we know that like about 20% of renters were behind on paying their rent. But among renters whose incomes were extremely low, so below $25,000 a year, about one in four were behind on rent. And so they were really struggling, and they still continue to struggle today to be able to afford their rent.
Andrew Arend is the vice president of research at the National Low Income Housing Coalition, an organization advocating for affordable housing.
For workers at the minimum wage, you know, they need to work on average about two full-time jobs just to afford a one-bedroom apartment. And if you're a single parent, you probably can't work 80 hours a week. And not only that, but you need more than a one-bedroom apartment.
According to real estate brokerage Redfin, rent across the country rose above $2,000 a month for the first time in May. Rents were up more than 30% in Nashville, Seattle, and Cincinnati, and nearly 50% in Austin.
As rents spike and inflation continues to rise, more and more families struggle to make ends meet. They turn to places like Catholic Charities for help in paying rent and utilities, as well as groceries.
Wills being one of them. Since July 2021, the Catholic Charities of the Diocese of Arlington, Virginia, has seen a steady increase in the number of people applying for assistance.
Keep that process rolling into our next phase.
Catherine Hassinger is the director of community services. She says most of her clients, ranging from seniors, families with children, and single mothers, are underemployed, working part-time in retail or food establishments.
As we were starting our last fiscal year, we were helping about 700 families with rent and utility assistance. We are now looking at almost 1,200 families that we're helping over that same quarter period. So we've almost doubled the capacity of families that are calling asking for help.
For fiscal year 2022, the Catholic Charities of the Diocese of Arlington provided an estimated $1 million in rent and utility funding to 2,000 people in need. That amount is 400% higher than what was provided in 2019 pre-pandemic. It's a total of about $4 million when also including food services. Christina Harrington serves as the pantry manager in the Sterling office. She says, along with generous donors and volunteers, they're able to continue to put food on the table for those in need.
We have about 40 to 50 families per week. At the end of the month, we usually serve about 800 to 1,000 family members. We have canned food, canned vegetables, fruit. We have pasta, rice, beans, all of your staples that you would normally find in your pantry, but we also offer fresh food as well, such as milk and eggs and cheese and butter.
Volunteers like Mary Catherine Williams help sort and organize the food, getting it ready for families to pick up.
They're always appreciative, and we always say, God bless, and come back next month, and it's great.
After reaching out to Catholic Charities and filling out the necessary paperwork, Wills has caught up on paying her rent and utilities. She is grateful.
Sometimes asking is hard because some of us have just been shut down so many times. There are organizations like the Catholic Charities, you know, like other entities that will just help you without judgment, which is the best thing, and offer you prayer all at the same time.
Russell Rages, EWTN News in Depth.
No matter what your economic status, high utilities, groceries, and gas cause stress and anxiety. Anthony Granado, Vice President of Government Relations with Catholic Charities USA, is on the front lines of helping those hardest hit by inflation. Anthony, it's so great to have you here with us. Is this a usual trend, what we just saw, where every couple of years you have a housing crisis, or is there something different and unusual about this specific crisis right now?
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having me. Yeah, we've been seeing affordable housing crisis for some years now. Even prior to the pandemic, this country was facing an incredible affordable housing crisis, an affordable housing shortage. If you recall, one of the data points prior to the pandemic, nearly 35 to 40% of Americans couldn't come up with $400 in emergency cash on a monthly emergency. The housing crisis has continued to be a problem. Just today, the Wall Street Journal is reporting housing affordability in June was at its lowest, its worst since 1989. So this crisis continues.
It's a significant crisis and one that doesn't only beg for financial literacy and planning, but for help. So then what do housing relief efforts look like at the national level? Do these resources come only from what the church does and gives, or is there also a partnership with the government or somewhere else?
It's both end, and that's really speaks to the church's teaching about the inherent dignity and justice, and shelter is a human right. It's an issue of justice. And as Catholics, we work with the public sector through private means and through public means. The goal is to help people and promote the common good. So Catholic Charities, on its private side, we have developed a program called the Healthy Housing Initiative. It's now 2.5 years into its process. It combines health and housing and existing diocesan property to help reduce homelessness between now and 2025. We're looking at reducing chronic homelessness by 20%. We have pilot cities, 5 pilot cities where this project has taken off, including Southeast Michigan, St. Louis, Southern Nevada, Portland, Oregon, and Eastern Washington State. The goal is to develop affordable housing and to bring the homeless population and actually hospitalization numbers down. People forget that there's a combination of homelessness and health costs that go up with homelessness. So this is a big project that we started in 2021.
Multifaceted efforts that you're trying to do to assess these issues and find solutions. Because you're talking about state-by-state efforts, are there areas of the country that are more immune to this than others, where people don't have as much need for Catholic Charities, or is this nationwide?
No, it's definitely nationwide. Rental prices are up 40%. This is a nationwide urgent matter. There's nowhere really safe, even in the D.C. area where we live here with some of the highest rents in the country. If you're not making 6 figures in your family, you're going to have a very hard time paying rent. So there's probably no place. If you look at inflation, inflation's come down a bit since 9.1%, down about 8.3%. But with rising gas costs, food costs, this is continuing to impact people everywhere throughout the country.
And from your experience, are there specific communities that are affected by this? Is it always the same community, a recurring issue? Or are you seeing more diversity in those who need help?
The diversity actually increases. You know, traditional cities like Portland, Oregon, we've seen a homelessness crisis in California. But there are places and rural communities where this is also going up. The pilot cities that we looked at, like Portland and Eastern Washington and St. Louis, even here in D.C., we don't have a pilot project here, but you look at homelessness and it's going up astronomically. So there's really no place that this is not touching. And if there's something that's not done, both by Congress and through private groups like Catholic Charities, homelessness is only going to rise further and people are going to have a hard time finding shelter.
Finding shelter and obviously finding work. I think that there is a correlation with the political reality for you right now and before. No matter who is in office, you're always tangling with what the government decides that it wants to do. Is there an outsized role that Catholic Charities plays in addressing these issues?
Oh, absolutely. Since 2021, just looking at the numbers last year, Catholic Charities provided 1.9 million persons with emergency shelter. We've been in developed about 35,000 affordable housing units and are currently in the process of developing 6,000 more. In 2021, we also teamed up with the Felician Sisters to develop the Francis Fund to Prevent Eviction, put together about $2.3 million up to $5 million to help keep people from being evicted. But Catholic Charities is calling on Congress to take further steps in the FY23 appropriations. We had hoped to see something in reconciliation to address rental assistance, housing vouchers, and of course, to develop affordable housing. Catholic Charities, we develop outside the government, one of the largest groups of Section 202 housing for seniors. But this problem is not going to go away, and both the private sector and the public sector need to do more to step up to help keep people from going homeless.
You mentioned the Felician Sisters. I'm sure that Catholic Charities isn't alone. Are there other orders of women religious or men religious that are helping with this issue?
Of course. This is an issue that transcends all of the religious orders. The church throughout the country, parishes are responding, dioceses are responding. It's a Catholic charity serves as the social ministry of the Catholic Church in the United States. So we're in a unique place to respond to the needs. We have people who have the experience, know how to develop an affordable housing units, provide counseling. The one thing I think that Catholic Charities brings to the discussion is the wholeness of the human person. We're about human flourishing. The church talks about integral human development. We're talking about mind, body, and spirit. So people who are impacted by homelessness are often people impacted with behavioral health concerns, addiction issues. And that's, you know, obviously private charity and the help of a parish is important, but sometimes people are going to need help with finding a job, dealing with issues such as addiction and other counseling. And so Catholic Charities, I think, is in a unique place to respond to homelessness and housing affordability.
Really quick, Anthony, what do the numbers look like? What kind of money is needed to step in and help alleviate housing emergencies? Is this comparable to the large amounts of money that Catholic Charities and Catholic Relief Services spend on disaster relief?
Well, I mean, it's hard to compare. I mean, disasters are very expensive. Right now, you see what's going on in Kentucky. Catholic Charities USA is responding there, as of course, well as the local agencies. It's very costly. You're talking about people who are devastated, who've lost their homes. You're talking about rebuilding. You're talking about an increase in homelessness. I was in El Paso and southern New Mexico about a month ago. The fires there in southern New Mexico were putting people out of their homes. You're talking about rural communities. The costs are going to be amplified by disasters, by whether it's fires or floods. And so Congress needs to step up. We're looking at what could be done in FY23 in appropriations. Again, we will continue to be doing this on the private side as well. People are generous. I think Catholics can be proud of the work of Catholic Charities, but it's going to take an all hands effort to address this scourge, which has been there since before the pandemic.
It's going to take the whole church coming together. Thank you so much, Anthony.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, a focus on young people, the effort to save street children from a life of despair in one African city, American teens helping their neighbors and growing their faith, and Catholic formation for students at the university level. EWTN News In Depth is coming right back.
I think it's a more open-minded or forgiving invitation for young people.
The outgoing president of the Catholic University of America discusses moral formation in the education system and his book that offers guidance on staying on a virtuous path. John Garvey is on the record when we return.
This summer, the education secretary unveiled a controversial plan to change Title IX rules in a move the Biden administration says will protect marginalized students. Title IX is a civil rights law that passed as part of the Education Amendments in 1972. It prohibits discrimination based on sex at federally funded schools. The Biden administration wants to expand the definition of sex to include sexual orientation and gender identity. The changes, considered divisive by many, would allow transgender students to use bathrooms, locker rooms, and compete in sports for the gender that they identify with. It's an issue that religious institutions are watching closely and that collides with church teaching. While the Biden administration says it will honor religious exemptions, many fear the new rules could threaten their religious liberty. I spoke with the outgoing president of the Catholic University of America, John Garvey, during his last week on campus about the implications Title IX changes could have as he steps down from his role after more than a decade of service. And we discussed his legacy as well as his new book, The Virtues, which dives into the role moral formation has in educational institutions. John Garvey joins us on the record.
President Garvey, it's so wonderful to be with you. Thank you for hosting us here.
Thank you for coming, Monty.
As the head of Catholic University for so many years, looking at your tenure at the Catholic University of America, what role does the university play in affecting American culture, and is it significant?
I think it's really important. In fact, it may be one of the most important things contributors to culture. We turn young people into different people over the course of their lives here. It's that four-year span for undergraduates is just life-defining. Aside from their life with their parents, there's nothing else in their lives that is as important to them, and they carry it with them. You know, I go to reunions every year with graduates, and people who are 40, 50 years out will still have the same set of commitments, the same ideology, the same ways of religious observance that they had when they were in college. They don't. Your mind gets shaped when you're that age, and it doesn't change much afterwards. So, we're turning out future citizens.
And as an institution, do people watch, do you think that people watch what the university does, what it stands for very carefully to mirror it in other Catholic institutions?
I hope so. we're the National University of the Catholic Church, and so we're trying to set an example for others. We're also, unlike many Catholic colleges that you might think of, we're a university. We have nearly as many graduate students as we do undergraduate students, and so we educate the teachers of other Catholic universities. The most famous president of Notre Dame is a graduate of Catholic University, Father Hesburgh. The current president of Villanova is a graduate of Catholic University. The last president of Providence College was a graduate of Catholic University. So we educate teachers and as well as undergraduates.
And many priests and religious as well.
Oh gosh, there was a time when they were our only students practically. But yes, most of the bishops, most of the cardinals in the United States are graduates of Catholic University.
There are some big questions around what this administration is doing to affect universities, specifically with Title IX, the redefinition of sex and how that, defining it rather than as binary, male and female, as sexual orientation and gender identity is pervading through the federal system, but also through the culture. How is that affecting universities around the world?
You know, I think it's a complete misdirection. Title IX was enacted shortly after I got out of college, and I think on the whole, it's been a really successful thing in this sense, that our women nowadays perform equally with men, actually outperform them in GPAs, and they perform equally in SAT scores. They're better athletes. We have more Olympic gold medal winners who are women. We teach young women, we teach girls and young women growing up that they can be anything, that they can be moms, that they can have jobs, that they can be Supreme Court justices, and that's just working fine for them. The Title IX problem today is guys. We're afraid to tell young men, this is what a young man ought to be, or this is what you should aspire to, or you should be strong, or you should take care of your family, you should, you can be president, you can be a gold medal winner. We don't tell our boys that, and so they're lagging behind. And the way to solve it is not to hold the girls back. That's been our success. But the way to solve it is to pay attention to our young men in our schools. And the focus on transgender issues is, driving us down an alley that's really not the main road we ought to be on.
This book that you wrote, it's actually a culmination of various lectures that you've given, of a course that you've given. What motivated you really to put this together into a book?
Thinking about virtues is a very appealing way of thinking about the moral life for young people. You know, the way we usually teach ethics in universities, in philosophy courses, and the way we talk about the moral life in Sunday sermons or in preaching to young people is often, don't do this, don't do that, this is bad, stay away from this sin or vice or whatever. And that's all useful to say, but young people want something to aspire to. They want something beautiful. They want to make their lives into projects that mean something to them. And so talking about virtues is a way of looking at the other side of the coin, but it's also a way of saying to people, think about this as a way to live your life. It's a very appealing invitation.
In the beginning of the book, you diagnose the university experience and the way that universities in the United States run it as having abdicated this very important role that universities used to play in building character for young people and in stopping that tapestry of moral and intellectual formation. Why is this such an important diagnosis?
There was a period in the middle of the last century and toward the end of the last century when what we might call liberal theories governed the way we ran universities. And what we told students when they arrived was, look, it's not our job to look out for your virtue or vice, for your behavior. We're not going to concern ourselves with that. We're interested in forming your intellect. The culture has actually moved to a point now where we do tell people that they ought to be this and not that. It's a rejection of the liberal ideology, just like my own, but it stresses values or a set of concerns about race, about gender, about abortion, about the environment. You should hold these views and not others on these subjects, and if you don't, you're bad.
Mm-hmm.
It's not improper for them to start thinking what sort of lives should people live and what's good and what's bad. That's the project that I'm engaged in as well. My approach in the virtues is to say, here's a good life to live. It's one that's prudent and just and brave and temperate and faithful and hopeful and loving. This is the way you ought to, isn't this the way you want to be? Not, we don't say, be this or you're bad. We say, here's an invitation to something that's beautiful.
President Garvey, many people fear that that anti-religious fervor can become protected as an ideology, then as a religion in the law, that this kind of secular humanism that does have views on everything and imposes itself in society to ask you to be something that is a rejection of something else, what we know as even just the moral beliefs of the church. Is that something people should be wary of?
What we all understand about religion is that it's something that that has to be freely embraced in order for it to be real. Agnostics are as much protected by the free exercise clause as Unitarians and Catholics and Jews. So it is really important that we protect the freedom of people to believe what they will about God and their own lives.
The ability to pursue everything you have here, these virtues, allow us to be free in a very different way than the way that the culture tells us that we're supposed to be free. Why is that important for university students to understand?
I wouldn't use the word free to describe what they enable us to do. I'd rather say, using the word free is a kind of reversion to liberal theory. Mm. It takes us back to saying we ought to be able to do what we want to do. I'd rather say that acting on the virtues or adopting or practicing the virtues that I speak about in my book allows you to develop a kind of character that makes you a good person. Mm. The virtues are ways of acting that we think are particularly appropriate for human beings because this is a good way for men and women to live. That's so a good rather than free is the way I would put it. And there is actually this real difference between those two ways of thinking. That's calling that freedom is an adoption of liberal theory, and freedom could be any sort of choice. Good suggests that that this is a way to act, and other ways are not as good as this is. Other ways might be as free as this, but not as good.
Thank you so much, President Garvey, for this, for your reflections, and for your leadership.
Thank you, Monsi.
President Garvey has more to say on Title IX. You can watch that in a previous interview I did with him on the EWTN YouTube page. Here's wishing former President Garvey continued blessings on his future endeavors. Headlines are next in The Week in Review.
What religious persecution looks like in Nicaragua, when police refuse to allow a priest to enter a cathedral to celebrate Mass. An independent investigation reveals more information about a German priest accused of sexual abuse who helped other priests escape prosecution. Analysis from a colleague covering Germany at the Catholic News Agency. And the Pope speaks out with advice on aging with grace. We'll be back in a moment.
New federal legislation signed into law tops the week in review. It was a week of bill signings and expected bill signings at the White House. On Tuesday, President Joe Biden signed into law the new bipartisan CHIPS Act. It invests nearly $300 billion over the next 5 years to help America regain a top role in making semiconductors. The world supply now comes mostly from Taiwan and China. Lawmakers from both sides of the aisle say this should ease supply chain problems for chips and bring down the price of cars and electronics.
We produce 0% of these advanced chips now, and China is trying to move away ahead of us.
Our over-reliance on foreign manufacturers is a real vulnerability. But as has been said, that's going to change.
The CHIPS Act also supports other high-tech manufacturing and critical research and development projects. Other legislation signed this week, the PACT Act, which expands health care benefits for veterans exposed to toxic burn pits. And a bill ready to be signed into law is the Inflation Reduction Act. The Inflation Reduction Act is a massive climate, health care, and tax bill, spending $430 billion to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and extend subsidies for health insurance under the Affordable Care Act. A major change to health policy gives Medicare the power for the first time to negotiate the prices for prescription drugs. The bill seeks to pay for the deficit through the new taxes, including 15% minimum tax on large corporations and boosting the Internal Revenue Service's ability to collect. An update now on the persecution of the Catholic Church in Nicaragua. It's a subject we covered extensively in a recent episode focusing on Christian persecution around the globe. The regime of President Daniel Ortega has placed the Bishop of Matagalpa, Rolando José Álvarez, under house arrest and threatened him with prison. Police are investigating the bishop, seen in this video, for allegedly trying to organize violent groups to destabilize the government. Bishop Álvarez, six priests, and six lay people were barred from walking to the cathedral to celebrate Mass after being placed on house arrest. Police blocked the streets. The bishop has been openly critical of human rights violations being committed by the Sandinista regime. Álvarez is asking the faithful to keep their hope alive in Christ. An independent investigation alleges a German bishop in Ecuador not only abused minors in several countries, but also helped pedophile priests wanted by authorities escape prosecution. It's a story our sister media outlet Catholic News Agency in Germany has been following since 2021. A statement from the German Bishops' Conference says that the late Bishop Emil Stehler has been accused of sexual abuse in 16 cases, as well as helping accused priests escape to Latin America by using money from the German Bishops' Conference. The statement from German bishops says the offenses spanned from his time as a priest in Bogotá, Colombia in the 1950s, as managing director of Aveniat, a German aid organization in Essen, Germany, as auxiliary bishop of Quito, and as bishop of Santo Domingo, both in Ecuador. To provide more insight on what is happening now in this investigation, we're joined by Catholic News Agency Germany's Deputy Director-in-Chief, Martin Berger. Martin, thank you so much for joining us. This is neither the first nor the last time we will see a scandal like this. Historical scandals will continue to surface. What is the church doing to provide care for the victims of these new allegations?
Well, first, it's good that things are coming to light now, whether it's sexual abuse or improper behavior or cover-up of this. There's one story in the report about a woman who in 1957 experienced improper behavior by Bishop Stehler, who was then still a young parish priest there. And she never talked with anybody about it, not even her parents. And then fast forward 60 years, over 60 years, she, when she was 80, she came forward just a couple of years ago and told the proper authorities about this. So that's definitely good. As far as what to do for the victims, the German bishops have certain systems in place, also compensation payments of up to 50,000 euros for an instance of abuse. And people can who have been abused can file, and an independent commission will examine what happened and then pay out these damages to them. They also offer help through psychologist sessions and so forth that will be paid for. And that's, at least a start.
It is a start. Stiele allegedly helped priests accused of abuse escape to other countries. Do we know who these priests are and if there are active investigations into their where they are?
Well, I mean, we as the public don't know the names. So in the report, it's only code names, FD1 through 19. 19 priests have been accused. But the person who did the investigation, the attorney, she knows the names and she forwarded those to the dioceses where these priests are from. And in the dioceses, the investigations then will begin and to look into these people. We know from one diocese, they already said one priest was apparently sent to Latin America to get rid of him because he was a problem because of abuse, sexual abuse of children in Germany. And then the vicar general wanted to just send him away so he wouldn't have to deal with the problem. That's the allegation, at least. They're investigating it now. So what we have to say, though, is it's three priests who are accused of having sexually abused people in Germany and then having left Latin America to flee from police who were looking for them. The other instances are not necessarily abuse cases or even improper behavior cases. There's some where just suspicions have been raised based on the files. So the weakest case, in my opinion, is that of a priest who switched from one Latin American diocese to another, and that happened unusually fast. So that raised flags for the researcher there, for the investigator, and also that a printout from his German parish website was in there about sexual abuse in general, not really connected to him, but it was in his personnel file. So he was just mentioned in there, but there's no direct or substantial connection. And the diocese, whichever one it is, must look into it and now see if there's anything to it or if it's just, you know,
right,
a weird coincidence.
So different facts in each one of these 19 cases. These allegations span multiple countries over decades. We know dioceses have pathways to report abuse, but this is international abuse. Is the church working on a more robust and comprehensive reporting system for cases like these?
Yeah, it's difficult with the communication, especially back in the 70s and 80s, because there were basically four players: the priest, the diocese in Germany, the diocese in Latin America, and then the Fidei Donum office, which was supposed to take care of these priests as they were in Latin America. But the priest could just reject that too, so they didn't have to have a connection to that office. So communication had to happen between those four players, and it didn't always happen. Sometimes there's one case described where a priest had returned to Germany already for several years, and the Fidei Donum office didn't know about it, and they were only told after several years. So the communication is definitely a problem, and it should be better.
Well, let's hope increases in communication take the benefit of new technology. Thank you so much, Martin.
Thank you.
The first phase of the Synod on Synodality comes to an end on Monday. That's when dioceses must finalize and submit their local synod reports. The diocesan phase focused on listening and gathering input from lay people in the church. Diocesan reports will be compiled by bishops' conferences and then by continent before they're reviewed by the Synod of Bishops at the Vatican in October of 2023. Of particular concern is making sure that the voices of young people are heard, including outreach through social media influencers.
So I think there's an awareness on the part of the Holy See and the part of the Synod of Bishops that young people need to be heard. There's often that phrase that they're the future of the church. Well, it's true, they are the future of the church, but they are also part of the present church, and they need to be heard. We need to find them, to hear from them, to hear their concerns and their worries.
Many parishes publish the results of their listening sessions online, but the church will not be able to gauge the full universal effect of the outreach until the Synod of Bishops comb the results next year. Pope Francis called the pursuit of eternal youth delusional in his general audience on Wednesday, his 16th and final reflection on the dignity of the elderly. Amid boisterous cheers, the Holy Father walked slowly onto the stage using a cane. He told the crowd that old age is a promise, not a threat, and that the conceit of stopping time, wanting eternal youth and unlimited well-being, is impossible. He explained that old age should be a time of expectation and preparation that brings one closer to God. The elderly are a promise, he says, the witness of a promise, and the best is yet to come. Pope Francis will begin to teach on a new, unannounced topic in his general audiences next week. When we come back, correspondent Colin Flynn takes us off to Africa.
we don't have enough rooms. Mm. That is why one of the mothers sleeping here with the children.
Little baby.
A home for children in one of the world's poorest countries. Street children are given a second chance here. The challenges, the struggles, and the hopes when we return.
The very important thing for me now, feeding and maybe medication.
Yeah.
At an orphanage in South Sudan, a severely low supply of basic life-sustaining essentials, food and medication. It's a dire issue facing thousands in the African country, but nuns, priests and lay people are trying to provide aid to the most vulnerable in society, children. EWTN News In-Depth correspondent Colin Flynn traveled to South Sudan and shares their humble work, bringing basic necessities, protection and hope to those in need.
South Sudan is the youngest country in the world, having gained independence in 2011. And now it is wrestling with a humanitarian crisis.
One of the things you notice here on the streets of Juba in South Sudan is the sheer amount of young people and children running around. Their clothes are often baggy and torn apart. They're malnourished. Many of them are drunk and they're begging for food. They're what's known as Juba's street children, and they're desperately looking for help.
A failing economy, broken families, hunger and poverty has pushed children like these into labor or life on the streets. Up to 3,000 children live on the streets, and that number is increasing daily. Many of these children are drunk or on drugs, and fighting is common. A group of priests and sisters try to rescue these children from the street and bring them to orphanages like this one, just on the outskirts of the city.
This is called St. Clair's House. Now, the conditions inside, they're quite dire, but most of these children here, they've come from the streets, and so the conditions here are still immensely better than where they've come from.
This room here, it is supposed to be like a store, but because we don't have enough rooms, that is why one of the mothers sleeping here with the children.
Showing us around is the woman in charge. The children know her as Mama Betty, the founder of the orphanage.
Oh, I see, sweating.
Yeah, it is sweating. Here we have problem of power. And they are not, sometimes it doesn't work.
Electricity is hard to come by in South Sudan. There is no national power grid. The orphanage has been without power for 6 weeks now, but can't afford to replace the batteries for their solar panels.
That is the room too small. Like this one, they sleep with the four or five children.
Four or five children in one bed?
Yeah, and then the one mother sleep with them.
So you could have one mother and five children in this bed squeezed in?
And then some of them sleep down.
On the floor?
These rooms have the bare minimum, not even a place for the girls to store their possessions. They have very little, but try and do the best with what they do have.
The very important thing for me now, feeding and maybe medication.
Yeah.
Yeah, but the rest, you know.
You have to have your priorities. Oh, it's dirty, isn't it, the wall?
This one, yeah, the water is dirty, but we cannot...
Upstairs, in a room that sleeps seven boys, we meet 17-year-old Clement, who shares his experience of living on the street.
Yeah, at night, it is dangerous. There are very many criminals moving at night, and if they find you, then they kill you.
Clement's parents both died when he was young, and so he was forced to fend for himself.
Before, when we were in the street there, no one who cares about us. But when Mama brought us here, now all things became okay. Life even is okay.
Are you happy here?
Yeah, we are happy here.
Mama Betty is doing her best to help these children, but it is always a struggle to make ends meet with the little resources and no help from the government.
They don't give me money, because they also say no money, you know?
They say we have no money.
Yeah, sometimes they work for 3 months, 4 months, no salary.
What are the children like? Are they traumatized?
They're traumatized. I need counseling. Like now, you see the sister, sisters helping a lot. You know, they put for them the music and the dance, and at least they get released.
Despite having so little and the conditions here being so bleak, and not to mention what it's like here in the rainy season, Mama Betty and the sisters try to do the very best they can to keep the children's spirits high.
I'm able to listen, and more of it is being present.
To showing them that they're worth something and have value.
They are loved, they are valued, and they are unique.
Isn't it difficult for them to hear that message about God's value for them, and they look around and think, well, why are we living like this, or we have so much hurt and pain and struggle and hardship?
I think sometimes the pain stretches one to even have trust in God more. When you know that there are times you did not have anything, but somebody was able to step in and even give you a meal, a single meal. So it builds more faith than discouragement, I would say, even when in the suffering years. My hope is that they will grow, go through education level as much as possible, and for those, and if they are not able to make it to white collar jobs, learn a skill whereby they can be able to be settled.
And no matter how bleak the reality is, there's no shortage of dreams in this orphanage.
What do you want for the future? What do you want to do in the future?
In the future, I want to be a doctor.
A doctor? Oh, wow. Why do you want to become a doctor?
A doctor is someone who is social, working for all the people. There are very many people like here in South Sudan. The situation is hard. A lot of people are dying. So I want to be a doctor so that I save even my nation.
You want to help your people?
God will see us through somehow. God will see us through, and I believe in God's providence.
For Mama Betty, the sisters, and everyone who's involved in this orphanage, what they want to do now is desperately upgrade the facility. They need to invest more in hygiene, in education, and in food. But to do that, of course, they need money. They don't get financial help from the government here in South Sudan, and so they will continue to rely on the generosity of private donors. In Juba, South Sudan, Cullum Flynn, EWTN News, in depth.
God will see us through. A heart-wrenching story about finding hope and compassion in the hardest of circumstances. To learn more about St. Clair's House for Children, go to the Sudan Relief Fund's website at sdnrlf.com.
I may be going to seminary after I graduate high school, and just being able to visit with priests and talk to friends who also may be discerning has just helped open my heart to the possibilities that are out there for me.
Next, we take a peek at what some Catholic teenagers were up to this summer. A heartfelt story from the heartland that will leave your heart full. Across the United States, summer vacation is coming to an end, and schools are beginning to welcome students back again. For high school students, summer is often a chance to relax, to work, and to spend time with friends. One summer experience for Catholic youth offers a chance to do all those things at once. Reporter Alan Holdren tells us about a summer camp for young Catholic kids that also enriches and deepens their faith journey.
One good work after another, teenagers in Kansas's Salina Diocese served people in their communities this summer. Prayer in Action is a week-long seasonal apostolate for students who want to do a mission trip close to home.
We go out during the day and do mission work within the community, painting houses, doing yard work, really just about any job that people need, we will do it for them. And then in the evenings, we come back and we do fun skits, fun things, and then also a lot of formative talks and discussions and prayer time as well.
We go out roughly six hours a day, and we put that prayer into action, helping sometimes not needy people, sometimes it's just people that just can't do it themselves.
It's a combination of
prayer while we do God's work.
We come together, several different towns, and just friendships are made here.
College students and adult sponsors volunteer to guide a group of as many as 60 high schoolers at a time for 5 days of mission work. In the Salina Diocese, they did 7 separate weeks between 2 cities this summer.
This year, I'm painting a house for someone who is elderly and has Parkinson's and just isn't able to do it on their own.
We also took this huge mountain of dirt and flattened it out.
Clean out weeds and cut down bushes and branches.
A lot of trimming trees and yard work.
The big part of it is coming together and forming a bond with the family you're working with, and it makes you feel really good.
I really enjoyed the adoration part of prayer in action too, just getting to sit in front of Jesus and just kind of spill out your heart to him.
You get them away from their phones and working together, and they form real friendships and bonds. One of my daughters said that she probably wouldn't be Catholic right now if she hadn't participated in prayer in action.
The apostolate was founded by a Salina Diocese seminarian in 2006. Today's second-year priest, Father Brian McCaffrey, is its chaplain. An experience like this changed his life, like it's changing theirs.
I was actually invited to go on the very first week, the very first summer of prayer in action in 2006 when I was in high school, and I said no, because I was like, that doesn't sound fun, you know? But I ended up going a couple years later because some of my friends told me, hey, you have to experience this. And so I went, and it changed my life. I tell people, I don't know if I would be a priest today if it wasn't for prayer in action.
What we do here at Prayer in Action is invite everyone to just be completely themselves and to enter into genuine community with each other and be fully present in the moment. And so I think that for a lot of people, that's a really powerful experience, especially the high school teens. And we just stress love, kindness, and being fully present to those in front of you.
And the effect on communities like Phillipsburg and Manhattan, Kansas this year is evident.
We need to be serving people. Those of us follow Christ, praying is one thing, but man, when you can put it to action, that's great.
When we were in Manhattan, the community told us that everywhere we went, just little pockets of love were exploding. You know, you work for one person and then their neighbors all hear about it, and that everywhere we go, there's little explosions of love.
Every time we serve somebody, they're just so gracious and they can't stop saying thank you.
Today, this missionary ministry is catching on, and the number of dioceses hosting Prayer in Action Weeks is growing. There's no lack of need for prayer, and there's no lack of need for action. In Kansas, Alan Holdren, EWTN News in Depth.
All 4 dioceses in Kansas now host Prayer and Action Weeks during the summer, and it's catching on in other places. Madison, Wisconsin, Savannah, Georgia, and Tucson, Arizona all have their own local crews now as well. And that does it for this edition of EWTN News in Depth. Staying on the theme of young people and students, next week, we focus entirely on back to school in a program devoted to education. I'm Montse Alvarado. We hope to see you again next week, same time, for more news and information important to your Catholic life. See you then.